The object and its occupant did not originate on Earth.
All right, you tell me where it is.
You are listening to The Files of the Disclosure Agents with your host, Victor Vigiano.
We're functioning much like, at the moment, native tribes on some little island in the South Pacific somewhere that has never had any contact with the outside world.
In a new book written by Dr. Richard O'Connor entitled UFOs, Nuclear Weapons, and a New Age of Reason, something very obvious but hidden has come to light. Our civilization has come into contact with intelligent, technologically advanced, and non-human civilizations. Recent admissions by semi-official Pentagon spokespersons are corroborating what previous U.S. military officers acting as whistleblowers have been espousing for more than two decades. These off-world civilizations have been temporarily disabling both U.S. and Russian nuclear weapons over a period of five decades at multiple nuclear weapons installations. How the U.S. and Russia choose to interpret and respond to these interventions may and likely will be critical to the future of our civilization. Let's join in on my conversation with the author of UFOs, Nuclear Weapons, and a New Age of Reason, Dr. Richard O'Connor. And Richard O'Connor, welcome to the Files of the Disclosure Agency. Glad to have you with us.
Thank you, Victor. It's great to be here, and I really appreciate you having me on.
Yeah, well, it's been a while since we've managed to get together. We've been promising each other one way or another that we chat. And I really was really taken, Richard, by your book, UFOs, Nuclear Weapons, and a New Age of Reason. How long ago did you publish it?
Oh, it's been a couple of months, almost a couple of months ago. Yeah.
Okay, good. How long did it take you to write it?
It took not that long. It took me probably about 6 months to write it. Mm-hmm. But when I finally did decide to go ahead and write a book, I really went at it. 15-hour days, a lot of them, you know, where I would just sit in the very office that I'm in right now and just work away on it. So once I got busy doing it, I got pretty serious about it.
Yeah, once you start the ball rolling, it's tough to stop it, especially if you develop a passion for a certain idea and you just got to get it on paper somehow. And those 15-hour days are usually pretty productive if you handle it the right way.
Yeah, that's what I found. And as I started working on it, I enjoyed doing the project, you know, and as you said, I do have a lot of passion for this particular aspect of the UFO phenomenon, the nuclear weapons aspect of it. And I think it's, for me, it's probably the most important part of the whole big picture.
It's odd that you have locked onto this issue in the way that you have. Because over the last, I'd say almost 6 months now, I've run into so many different people, and even during interviews, and this whole idea of the nuclear issue has come up over and over again. And one of the things that I've noticed is that this could be one of the conduits through which we could eventually make some sort of sense to the visitors. In other words, they are quite clearly locked into who we are as a species, and looking at us from their perspective. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we don't know who all they are, but I think they are very concerned about what I call extinction behaviors. And I know nuclear weapons is probably the number one, other than the climate issue, extinction behavior that we as human beings engaged in. And that led me into, you know, getting your book and opening up and reading it. And I was really taken aback by your metaphor that most of us, you know, born in, I guess, the late 40s, early 50s, and even after that, were born with a nuclear weapon strapped to our back. Where did you get that metaphor from? How did that come to you?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I don't know. I was looking at these pictures that were very reminiscent of my own past in grade school when we would have these drills, and they would have us children go under our desks for these duck and cover drills, you know, and I just thought how ridiculous it is that, you know, from the very moment we're born on this planet, and most of us that are living today have been in this situation where we could potentially be destroyed by a nuclear holocaust any day, any hour. And we all just sort of are mum about it. You know, we don't seem to really think about it day to day. And we sort of assume that these men in uniform, both here in the U.S. and other nuclear armed countries, are going to take care of things, and they're never going to let something like that happen. I don't feel that confidence that many people apparently do. You know, I feel that accidents happen. We see this in our lives all the time. So Why should we assume that some terrible accident with nuclear weapons won't one day happen? And it's not gonna take a big nuclear exchange to set back our civilization, you know, decades to centuries. Or, you know, possibly, like you said, an extinction event. So I just started feeling like, you know, I have to write this as a human being and a citizen of this planet. I've got to speak up about this. I've got to try to motivate people to begin to maybe get a little bit more concerned about this than everybody seems to be. It's like we just walk around presuming that nothing bad's going to happen, but I just don't have that confidence.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's incredible that lack of confidence in the militaries around the world, you know, especially the United States and Russia, I guess, that level of confidence that everything is going to be okay because no one's going to come near that button and there really won't be a trigger event so we can all kind of go to sleep at night. But I know there are many, many people here on the planet who go to bed fearful of that event and putting their head on the pillow and saying, my God, I hope it doesn't happen tonight or tomorrow morning. And the way things are going right now on the planet, the number of I don't know exactly what to call it, but the state that that our global family is in right now, it wouldn't take much for somebody to do something really off key and really begin something that they just can't stop. They just won't be able to stop the ball from rolling down the hill. The events are happening every day. You know, I watch television up here in Canada, and I try to tune into, you know, some of the U.S. programs, the news programs in the States, and any one of those things, anything that's happening right now, could in some way trigger some sort of event that would lead to what you're looking at. The other aspect of it is, in addition to the nuclear weapons issue, is the whole idea, Richard, of nuclear energy being the panacea for the solution to the fossil fuel problem that we're having in terms of, you know, global warming and all of that. How does your mistrust of the nuclear issue in terms of weapons, how does that sort of fold into your understanding of the nuclear issue with respect to energy?
Well, you know, I think what we're doing clearly is not going to be sustainable for any length of time into the future. You know, we've got to make some changes here. And nuclear energy is one of the things that's on the table. You know, we should all be concerned and I think a little bit mistrustful of nuclear energy, because we've seen some pretty serious accidents occur that have not yet been resolved even today. You know, at Fukushima in Japan, they're still dealing with that problem and still trying to figure out what they're going to do with these barrels and barrels they have of this contaminated radioactive tritiated water. You know, it's got high concentrations of tritium in it. They've been able to get most of the cesium and the strontium out of the water, but the tritium, they're having a really difficult time figuring out how to deal with that. And in the meantime, these barrels and barrels and barrels of this contaminated water that they're having to store there, you know, near the plant, are just stacking up like crazy. And you know, one of the things that they've actually talked seriously about is dumping it into the ocean, and that's actually a proposal that is on the table. So these things can have very long-term, very difficult to solve problems. So I'm not a huge fan of nuclear energy, and not only are nuclear weapons and that issue that's been brought to our attention by, I call them the others, whoever mm-hmm. they are. I'm quite certain that they're real, and I'm quite certain, as you said, that they're interested in our nuclear capabilities and our apparent willingness to self-destruct. But if people would pay attention to that aspect as well of this issue and think about, you know, how do these craft produce the energy that they require to do what they've been observed to do? And, you know, that would include, like, if you look at the data from the Tic Tac UFO incident, and in the statement that that UFO moved 60 miles in 5 seconds to David Fravor's previous, his squadron's, what they called the cap point there near the Nimitz, where they were to regroup and rendezvous. You know, that calculates out to a horizontal velocity of 46,000 miles an hour.
Unthinkable.
So that takes a lot of power, you know? You always hear people say, oh, it took off like a bullet. Well, no. It took off much differently than a bullet, because the average velocity of a bullet is about 1,200 miles an hour. These things are, like, so much faster than a bullet. It's not even a comparison. So how do they do that? Well, they apparently can generate a great deal of energy.
Listen to the Files of the Disclosure Agency on Spotify, and you'll hear it all.
If you look at the data from the UFO that landed near Dalnogorsk, Russia, and I believe that was in 1986, those scientists that went out there to investigate that site discovered that that particular event, in what they estimated to be 10,000 gigawatts of power that were generated by that UFO when it took off from the top of that hill near Dalnogorsk, Russia. You know, people may scoff at that and say, well, I never heard of that. Well, at the Area 51 exhibit in the Smithsonian-affiliated Museum for Atomic Testing in Las Vegas, Nevada, I saw, you know, with my own eyes in that exhibit, a display that said authentic alien artifact. It had some test tubes full of this amorphous, looked like kind of burned metal that was recovered from that hilltop outside of Dalnogorsk, Russia. This was a real event, and the scientists from this university in the Ukraine that went out to investigate that came up with some astounding figures for the power output that UFO showed evidence of, you know. So not only, you know, this topic, it has so many fruitful avenues that we could go down if people will become serious about it and start to engage with it in a way that it becomes, as it has been for you, and it certainly is for me, a daily, I would have to call it almost a compulsion.
Yeah, you know? Yeah, I know what you
it's
mean.
Something that I have to engage with this. I see it as being so important, not really just, you know, to my own life, but really more to the point, to the future of human civilization. At some point, people have to stop, look up, start learning about this, and begin paying close attention to this. It's the most important topic of our times.
We're speaking with Richard O'Connor, author of UFOs, Nuclear Weapons, and A New Age of Reason. The idea that you just brought up a second ago about the way we need to kind of allow a new awareness to unfold about who the others are, and how they impact upon us. If you transfer some of those philosophical questions into the practicalities that you mentioned earlier about the power of these weapons, I mean, they're moving at, you know, 46,000 miles an hour in our own atmosphere, not burning up and not having any kind of sonic boom. They must be some sort of special craft. These things are not from China or Russia or some other you know, foreign power. They are from off-world civilizations. And I feel totally comfortable in making that assertion and not having to defend it. How do you feel about that?
I feel that it's an absolute certainty that they don't belong to any country on this planet. Now, the whole question of whether the US or Russia or China have developed some sort of a reproduction vehicle, you know, I leave that on the table. I think that's a possibility, but it certainly doesn't explain so many different historical aspects of the phenomenon that have been going on, you know, like, I mean, you look back at all of these paintings from the 1400s, the 1700s, where unmistakable UFOs were painted into these paintings from antiquity. You look back at some of the Egyptian hieroglyphics and these things that were literally engraved in stone that look exactly like, for example, the children that were at the Ariel School. I believe that was like around 1996 when that happened, when a UFO landed at the Ariel School in Zimbabwe. And these 64 children, I believe, that were there all saw it and described a being that got out of the craft and interacted with them telepathically. It, in the pictures that those children drew of what they saw, this being, that one of those girls who was 11 years old at the time said, when she was asked, how close to you was this being? She said, 1 meter.
Yeah.
1 meter. You know, and if people will watch, I believe that segment is taken from that documentary that James Fox produced called The Phenomenon.
That's correct.
Everybody should watch that. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a really important film. But, you know, the pictures that those children drew look exactly like what you see drawn into the stone, you know, chiseled into stone in some of the displays that we found in Egypt. And so these beings have been with us for a long, long time. And, you know, if you go back just to the 1950s, you've got videos from like Nick Mariana right here in Great Falls, Montana, which is 100 miles north of me, who took a video, one of the first videos of two UFOs that were flying over Great Falls. When he was interviewed, he said, well, they stopped in midair and they were spinning and they looked like discs and they were really shiny. You know, I mean, he saw these things very clearly. The problem is that those that have controlled this information for so long have trained people in our society to mistrust the word of one another. And this has been very destructive, I believe, to the fabric of our society here in the U.S. And it probably has, you know, influenced some Canadian citizens as well. When our fellow citizens tell us these things, that this is what I saw, this is what happened, we've been trained through the media and through the disinformation people to discount it and to push it away. And I think that that's really unwise, because if you know, there's a YouTube, for example, of Nick Mariana being interviewed about these two UFOs that he videoed. He said he saw it very clearly. You know, the Delbert Newhouse was another guy who back in the 1950s videoed a fleet, really, I would call it a fleet of UFOs over Tremonton, Utah. And he and his wife were very clear about what they saw. And Evelyn Trent, if you listen to what Evelyn Trent said about what happened with her and Paul Trent the day they went out and took those photographs, two photographs of the UFO there near McMinnville, Oregon, you can tell that this lady is telling the truth about what she saw and what happened.
Listen to the Files of the Disclosure Agency on Spotify, and you'll hear it all.
You're bringing up a really good point, because the keepers of the secret have had their way for well over 75 years, and just now recently it's sort of seeping out along the edges of the wall of secrecy. You know, I generally describe what's going on right now as the wall of secrecy surrounding all of this is beginning to crumble, and eventually is going to crumble to a point where there'll be a hole in this thing you could drive a truck through. Do you see that secrecy coming to an end, slowly waning away? How do you see this secrecy unfolding in terms of its non-relevance, and that people will eventually be able to take the word of a fellow human being and say, yes, I believe what you are saying, I believe what you saw, as a matter of fact, I know what you saw is true? How do you think the secrecy is going to become a thing of the past, if it will ever?
Well, you know, unfortunately, I think a lot of that is going to depend on where they're going with what you and I and people that are paying attention to this would interpret to be the sort of incipient stages of some sort of a disclosure process that's going on. That seems to be the case. I don't think that we are far enough into it yet where they couldn't shut the door on it anytime they want to again. I think, you know, basically all it would require is just them saying, well, we're not releasing any more data and we're not going to talk about this any further.
Yeah.
That'd be pretty much the end of it, you know? So I think a lot of it depends on the intentions of the people that are involved in orchestrating what's been going on for the past 70 years. I mean, a lot of those people, obviously, that began this program of misinformation and disinformation are dead now, you know, but others have taken over in those roles. And what I'm hopeful is that the people that are in charge of this now actually have sort of had an epiphany about where the human race seems to be headed and are going to, you know, follow through with what they've begun. And I can only hope that that's what's going to happen.
The idea, too, that you're kind of leading towards that I see is one of the really devastating incidents or series of incidents that have happened in terms of some of these craft coming down and hovering over nuclear installations at Malmstrom Air Force Base and in those areas. And Robert Salas, a good friend of mine, by the way, the things that they have talked about with respect to what these things are actually doing. And in your book and even some of the discussions that we've had before, you allude to the fact that these are warnings or admonitions. The others haven't really come down here and stopped these things or destroyed them. You look at these incidents as warnings, and that it's going to force the military who's in charge of these things to give things a second thought and make some key decisions about what's really going on. Because I'm firmly of the belief, Richard, and I think you would share it too, that people inside the Pentagon and the Department of Defense of the United States know exactly how these things have come down and done this stuff to their nuclear assets. They know that for sure. They just haven't articulated it like Robert Salas has. What do you think their interpretation of how these shutdowns, first of all, occurred, and what they're going to do about it, and what it's really saying about what they have to do in terms of the warnings that the others are sending us?
Yeah, well, you know, certainly my own perspective is equivalent to that of Robert Salas and Robert Jacobs and other people that have known about this and testified about it, that these events in which, as you say, the others have, you know, hovered over these sites, and they've temporarily disabled the missiles, okay, and they didn't destroy them. And so for me, and I think for anybody that really gives this some careful thought, what that indicates is that we have some important decisions to make ourselves. You know, this has been definitely brought to our attention, but not in a way that I would interpret it as some sort of a hostile act. Now, I'm sure that the people in the Pentagon who sit around and contemplate war for a living and contemplate national security and the risks to national security for a living, you know, I'm sure that they look at this quite differently. But in my opinion, if they're looking at it as if it's some sort of an act of war or anything other than an act of compassion, an act of not wanting to see the human race go up in a nuclear mushroom cloud. So I think the others care. You know, they've cared enough to come down here on multiple occasions and demonstrate to us how foolish this is. And so if the people in the Pentagon are interpreting these events as anything other than that, I think they're making a huge mistake. And I have to think that you know, we hear a lot of talk about, well, we have to study UFOs more. We've got to really get scientific about this. And, you know, Professor Avi Loeb there at Harvard has recently started the Galileo Project, where they're going to begin looking with radio telescopes and also with optical telescopes for near-Earth objects that are sort of, they postulate to possibly be, I think, I forget the term that they're using for it, but sort of techno-signatures of alien civilizations visiting Earth. Well, I have no doubt that they're going to find them because, you know, the National UFO Reporting Center gets about 400 reports a month. So once they start looking for this in a serious way, I have no question that they're going to come up with some important data very quickly. But this idea that this is the route we need to follow, you know, that we have to study these scientifically and we've got to learn all about how they work and the implication is what their vulnerabilities may be, I think that's the wrong path, you know.
Yeah.
I feel like what we need to be doing is we need to be trying to make contact with these beings. And that's probably the biggest point that I raise in my book, you know, is that we need to start talking to these beings and opening up a peaceful and a transparent relationship with them. And I will say that what I think it's going to take for us to do that is I think that, we're going to have to abandon our nuclear weapons. I think that they've been very clear about it, you know?
And very patient.
Extremely, extremely patient. You know, they've shown us some courtesies that I don't think that most people really appreciate the depth of the patience involved and the courtesy involved in going, you know, through the trouble to basically try to help our civilization along and through these very perilous times that we're in right now. I feel that that's going to be a prerequisite, Victor, that we abandon our nuclear weapons programs, that we sit down all the nuclear armed nations, including North Korea, including China, Russia, you know, the U.S., Pakistan, all of us sit down at a table and just say, okay, we're not leaving this table until we figure out a way to get rid of nuclear weapons. And I think that is eminently doable if people will just develop the mindset that that's what has to happen. So I don't know, I'm sure a lot of people in the Pentagon would call me naive and say that that stance is ridiculous. That could never happen, but it's not going to happen unless people decide to make it happen.
Precisely, yeah. Right. I think the broader question that you're raising is with respect to the others and their patience and what they've been doing so far and how they've interacted or engaged us, is that to sit around a table and have some consensus developed among all of the nuclear nations of our own kind of volition, of our own impetus, is one thing. But do you think that it might take, quote unquote, I don't like the term, a show of force or some sort of display by the others to say, okay, folks, you know, the time is up, not for us, but for you guys. You have to sit down and do something about this situation. And we're going to give you a certain period of time to get this thing fixed up. And if you can't do it, you're on your own. And if you begin taking nuclear weapons out into space and into the cosmos, we're not going to let that happen. We're not going to let a dangerous race take these things out. So you will be quarantined, so you will not be able to leave your solar system, fool around on the moon, fool around on Mars, but that's fine. But you will not be allowed to take your weapons into space. Where will they draw the line, do you think, in your own opinion? Because that's a very strong point that you make in the book about contacting them and getting a narrative or a dialogue going with them about this whole issue, which some people think is just sort of a fairy tale. But I, in fact, believe that is exactly what's required. Before we go, Richard, your website or a website, and what's the best way to get a hold of your book?
Yeah, so the website that I use mostly is cropcirclesresearchfoundation.org. And my book is available from Amazon only at this point. It's available in both a print and an ebook version.
Richard O'Connor, thank you so much for joining us here in the Files of the Disclosure Agency. As usual, we only kind of scratched the surface. And thank you so much, Richard, for joining us. And all the best in the work that you're striving for.
Thank you, Victor, and thanks for the work that you're doing. This is so important, and you know, if we all keep working together, we're going to get this done. We have to.
No choice at all, for sure. Okay, good night.
Take care.
You have been listening to part one of our discussion with Dr. Richard O'Connor on his new book, UFOs, Nuclear Weapons, and a New Age of Reason. Join us for part two on Spotify for our discussion with Dr. O'Connor about his take on how the human family must eliminate nuclear weapons in order to survive on the planet Earth.
The Files of the Disclosure Agency was recorded at the Zeeland Communication Studios in Toronto, Ontario. Sound engineer, Brian Thomas. Research, Victor Vigiani. Follow us on Twitter at Zeeland. That's ZLAND. Let's talk again soon.
Functioning.
much like at the moment native tribes on some little island in the South Pacific somewhere that has never had any contact with the outside world.